This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
Top-notch, value-added, hot-off-the-presses news.
Bloomberg puts out thousands of news stories a day, but some really stick with you.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm Denise Pellegrini, and on this weekend edition of Bloomberg Best...
It's a done deal. The global economy is going into recession.
Mohammed El-Erian says he's afraid that people are too optimistic.
Nationalizing the entire stock market.
If things get worse, could the Fed step in and buy stocks?
It's important to first focus on your health and then secondarily on survival.
And taking the long view on the coronavirus.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Remember Nouriel Roubini, the investor who had so much insight about the financial crisis? Well, now the chairman and CEO of Roubini Macro Associates says the U.S. economy was already weak even before the coronavirus hit hard. And Jonathan Farrell begins here by asking Roubini about the formal recession Roubini is expecting instead of a presumably milder rolling one.
Well, initially, market thought that there'll be a recession in the first quarter only in China, Japan, Korea, and maybe Italy. And then by the second quarter, we'll have a recession in U.S. and Europe. And by the third quarter, we'll be growing everywhere around the world. That will be a rolling recession. To have a technical recession, you need to have at least two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. But if you look at the United States, based on the retail numbers, even just for February, let alone the collapse in March, we're going to have negative growth already in the first quarter in the United States. In the second quarter, even JP Morgan says that output and GDP are going to fall at an annual rate of at least 15%. And then the optimists say we're going to have a recovery in the third and fourth quarter. But my numbers say that given the spread of the contagion, and by the way, 2 weeks from now, at this rate of spread of the contagion, in U.S. we're going to have 100,000 cases, okay? 100,000 cases. They're growing 30% per day. So in 1 week, we'll be at 50, and in 2 weeks, we're going to be at 100. So this implies that things are going to get worse, and the economy is not having a V-shaped recovery. It's not having a U-shaped recovery. It's not having an L-shaped recovery. Right now, the economy is like an I. It's like a stick dropping faster than the global financial crisis, faster than the Great Depression. The Great Depression took 4 years in 29-33 that we got the Depression. Today, in a matter of a month, we've had a collapse of economic activity that is worse than the Great Depression. We've never seen something like this in human history. It's like an asteroid hitting the Earth and essentially leading a collapse of all economic activity. So that's what we're facing right now. So people talk about V, not even a U, not even an L. We're in an I. We're in a free fall right now. Let's be honest about it. I mean, people are still delusional, both the markets and people who talk about the V. What are they talking about?
Well, Nouriel, let me jump in, because I think people are finally waking up to the calls that have been made over the last couple of weeks. And respectively, I think we're going to leave the health predictions to the public health professionals, because it's really, really difficult to predict right now, Nouriel. And what I think we can do with you that would be typically really, really quite useful, actually, is to focus on policy and the policy response. Have you been encouraged by what you're seeing in Washington, D.C., not on the monetary policy side, but on the fiscal policy side?
I've been saying for a while, you can use the entire monetary bazooka. Unless you have the fiscal bazooka, things are not going to be enough. But there are two things that are going to keep the market pushing down towards stock markets falling 40 to 50%. One is the real economy is in free fall. Earnings expectations are being revised down, but the actual number is going to surprise severely on the downside. But the key policy response that is still failing is the health policy response, because the market can price risk. The markets cannot price uncertainty. Uncertainty meaning a distribution is not normal, that has fat tail. And unless we do massive, massive testing, we don't know how many people are sick. And unless we go to Chinese style of quarantine, meaning everybody is at home for a month or two, locked down fully of everybody around the country, this thing is going to spread like wildfire. So markets are not going to reach the bottom until, in addition to the fiscal response, we have the real health policy response. And given this uncertainty, and we're going to have 100,000 people sick 2 weeks from now, officially, the actual number might be higher, the market, given this uncertainty, can head only south. They cannot stabilize.
And that was Noriel Roubini, Chairman and CEO of Roubini Macro Associates, with Bloomberg's Jonathan Farrell. We also had a chance to check in with Walgreens. Dr. Kevin Ban, the company's chief medical officer. Bloomberg's Alex Steele begins here by asking about Walgreens' plans for coronavirus testing. Let's listen in.
We're partnering with the federal government on this. These will be mobile testing sites that incur in our parking lots. The federal government will be the one responsible for all of the logistics around that. We're supporting in the effort. And what we intend to do is, you know, we've got 9,200 stores across the country. We'll start with a few of them, and then we'll ramp that up. And, of course, as soon as we know that, we're going to make sure that we're communicating with the public.
What's the number one thing that you need to make that happen quickly and efficiently?
You know, quite honestly, we're poised to do this quickly and efficiently. You know, we've got the sites across the country. It's a matter of just choosing which ones are the right ones and then making sure that the federal government partners with us to be able to just to get the sites up as quickly as possible.
What's the holdup on the federal government side? Anything you insight you can give us there?
No, I think everything's moving along as we expected. You know, we're putting all the pieces together. You can imagine it's a, you know, very complex, but we're moving along as planned. And as I said, we'll be the first to communicate all that information once we have it.
You also worked in Italy to develop emergency medicine. This was kind of back in the day after you became a doctor. Looking at what they did, can you give some insight into what we can do differently to flatten that curve and also to deal with any reinfection rate we might be looking at?
Yeah, I think the fundamental message is social distancing. The most important thing that we do, Alex, is that we have to be deliberately but politely antisocial.
And that was Dr. Kevin Ban, Chief Medical Officer at Walgreens. And coming up, some tips for those trying to time the market. You're listening to Bloomberg Best. This is Bloomberg Best. I'm Denise Pellegrini. Is now the time to actually jump in and buy U.S. stocks? Well, as you can imagine, some investors are saying not quite yet. One of them is Danny Young. He's Chief Investment Officer and founding partner at Diamond Asia. He says there will be light at the end of the tunnel next month. He speaks here with Bloomberg's Haslinda Aman and Ivan Mann.
Wow, what a difference a month makes, right? You know, on 19th of February, we saw the S&P at the all-time highs at 3,400. I think it's going to be tough. I mean, on one hand, you know, every month the ECB now will be buying, you know, over 115 billion euros of assets. That's the highest ever. Right. So, I mean, at the peak of the crisis in Europe, you know, they were buying 80 billion a month, and now it's 115 billion. And, you know, in spite of that, the market's a lot lower. So I would say on one hand, there'll be a lot of liquidity in the system. You know, a lot of, you want to call it helicopter money or handouts that need to be made, you know, just to keep the lights on. Right. Because in the consumption and demand destruction, you know, jobs will be lost. And so as a result, handouts all across the world, you know, basically helicopter money will kick in. But at the same time, because this is a health crisis and there's a massive lack of confidence, the spending will be lacking, the investments will be lacking. So people will be sitting on a lot of cash until the, I would say, the virus situation settles down. You know, but
Danny,
I think on that,
Danny, you talk about the bazookas, everything and the kitchen sink, yet we see tumble after tumble. I mean, how much risk has been priced in, given the fact that we're facing a recession and basically everybody has run out of ammunition?
Absolutely. I think maybe where the next where there could be more ammo would be if the central banks or the treasury, you know, starts buying equities as well. You know, it's not in the mandate at the moment for the Fed, but it could be if it comes to a point of, you know, an emergency. But then that will be essentially, you know, over time nationalizing the entire stock market, right? Which I don't think is good for the financial system either. So whilst the kitchen sink is thrown in, I think now it's more a matter of, you know, how does confidence come back? You know, where everyone is scared and worried about their lives and their health and staying home. You know, but at the same time, maybe, you know, I think it was fortunate for us out here in Asia, you know, having lived through and watched the virus, in the first phases, right, in China and then as well as Singapore and other parts of Asia, you know, and I think that playbook, you know, life eventually does go back to normal, right? So, you know, there'll be a moment of peak fear where, you know, the transmissions go exponential. And then, you know, there will be the actions where, you know, the home quarantines and, you know, essentially working very aggressively to contain the spread. And when that happens, you know, based on our studies, about 30 days after, basically virus transmissions go exponential, things start to calm down. And I think that will start to happen in Europe by the end of March or early April. And for the U.S., it should be about middle of April to the end of April. So I think we'll get there, right? So once the people start to go back out, you know, life needs to go back on. Everyone, you know, basically it goes like stir crazy, you know, with cabin fever. And then I think things will start to settle, right? So it's not so much about bazooka or liquidity. I think that is just to hopefully keep businesses afloat, for a couple of months. But then we need people back to work and spend.
Danny, it's Yvonne in Hong Kong. Thanks so much for joining us. What are your clients telling you now? Have you seen any withdrawals?
Not yet. I would say clients, again, I think, you know, it's fortunate that our fund tends to do well in volatile situations. In fact, when I was sitting at your offices, in December of this year, we were exactly calling for investors to own, you know, tails and own volatility that, you know, we felt that the markets were too complacent, that a big tail event, you know, was overdue. And so to me, I would say that we have provided a decent hedge for clients. But at the same time, it feels to me that the longer term investors have not capitulated. So I would say the fast money, you know, the alternatives funds, you know, some of the CTAs and algos have capitulated, as well as some retail investors and high net worth. But I would say the longer term pension funds still are in the camp, and rightly so, that we should look through this crisis, you know, for the next 3 to 6 months. But it will be scary, right? Because you will start to see earnings fall off a cliff, right? So, you know, it takes a leap of faith and confidence that you can ignore, you know, basically an earnings recession of 50 to 90% for some companies, right? Yeah. So for now, investors are still, longer-term investors are still, standing pat.
Okay, so longer-term investors are still there, but, you know, in the next coming weeks or months, as you're forecasting, perhaps things will start peaking when it comes to the number of infection cases. Are we likely to see more disruption in the hedge fund industry where we'll see more funds have to liquidate this quarter?
I think there will be some liquidation, and in fact, you know, part of the reason this I'll say the next wave of the sell-off, right, it coincided with the Saudi-Russia basically oil disagreement leading to oil prices falling 30%. And as a result, you know, some maybe, sovereign wealth funds actually needing to shore up their reserves and hence putting in redemptions. But at the same time, I think, you know, we've had this almost perfect period of 10 years where passive investment, you know, looked like it could do no wrong, right? Where investors just felt, you know, I'll just pay this 10 basis points and be long and I don't need hedge funds. I think maybe this period could be a reminder that, you know, that there is still a place for active managers in the portfolio, you know, because, you know, every so often we do have these massive flash crashes and they will still recur, you know, in the years ahead.
Danny, how does your portfolio look right now? And how are you hedging the tails?
I think the tails have already played out. But at the same time, I believe that countries that are very dependent on exports, you know, twin deficit countries, you know, countries that run a fiscal deficit, you know, as well as a trade deficit, will face continued pressures on their currency. As countries like Australia, New Zealand, you know, basically every country is rolling out massive stimulus. They have to fund this. Basically, it puts them into a much more precarious situation from a fiscal front, right? So the deficit countries go into deeper deficit and therefore, you know, flooding the market with liquidity, but at the same time putting their fiscal situation in a much worse situation.
That was Danny Young, Chief Investment Officer and Founding Partner at Diamond Asia, with Bloomberg's Haslinda Amin and Yvonne Mann. And coming up, why gold could really be about to glitter again. You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Denise Pellegrini. Gold and the dollar are, of course, intertwined. And Wayne Gordon, Executive Director for Commodities and Foreign Exchange at UBS Global Wealth Management, tells us he's betting on the yellow metal right now. Here he is with Bloomberg's David Inglis and Yvonne Mann. Let's listen in.
Okay, so when I think about what would I buy in the right here and now, I would be buying gold here. It's very clear that the U.S. dollar squeeze that we've seen, you were just speaking about the dollar strength then, is continuing and may continue at least for the next few weeks. If we, although we can't draw parallels between this situation we're in today relative to 2008 completely, what we can say is that credit does seem to be squeezing, and that's pushed this broad demand for the dollar. What that effectively has done is seen people liquidate any positions they can get US dollar cash from. Gold has been one of them. What I would make the observation is here that the real interest rates in the US have shifted from being negative 0.5 to about plus 0.6 or so over the last week or two. That, of course, has a very negative impact on gold. And, of course, the US dollar, which has a traditional negative correlation with gold, has also been pressuring the yellow metal. So how I would look to this is that this may, this sort of malaise may continue over the next week or two as the Fed continues to do their work behind the scenes. But inevitably, we will get some unwind of the dollar strength. And in fact, under the position of additional QE, you should see a weaker dollar over the next 12 months. And also on the back of that, you'll see real rates go back into negative territory. That will be a potent power for gold. So you can see gold again approaching that sort of mid-1600s to 1700 over the next 3 to 6 months.
All right. So, Wayne, you mentioned about that rush for dollars. It seems like the Fed, central banks have thrown everything and the kitchen sink into providing some liquidity. Is it that the dollar is just going to remain strong for some time? And what ultimately still needs to happen to really bring down the dollar?
Okay, so I think a lot of the squeeze has come from the corporate side on a global basis, as well as from the major banks. So effectively, particularly on the corporates, as we can see, some of the really big corporates, such as the airlines, et cetera, who have had to draw down on credit lines that they probably haven't had to touch for a very long time. Not only that, but while we had a household balance sheet crisis and I suppose a broader banking crisis in the GFC, this time around, over the last few years, corporates have done a lot of buybacks. They've done a lot of distribution of cash. They haven't wanted to hold cash so much on the balance sheet. Now they've got to return to sort of holding more cash to carry them over this period of what is going to be, has been very weak demand in Asia and is now transmitting to very weak demand in Europe as well as the US. So we need to start to see those lines of credit, particularly the small to medium enterprises, start to work, and then people will get more confidence that people can hold on until we get through this crisis. Then we'll start to see the dollar turn, because in the end, people will want to try and seek yield after all of this has happened. And so where is yield highest? It's highest often out in Asia. And so you'll start to see that rotation out of US dollar assets back into Asian assets, etc. That is going to be a powerful force to weaken the dollar.
What do I do in the next 2 weeks?
I think at least in the short term, holding dollar is probably where you would put yourself. We have seen quite a shift higher in the Aussie dollar, as an example. Now, I'm not confident yet to be allocating into cyclical currencies. But what we have seen is yield spreads have shifted from being deeply negative in Australia, for example, and now they're actually positive against US 10-year yields, US 5-year yields. And so you are starting to see a yield premium build up there. But for my next 2 weeks, I would continue to sit in the dollar, wait for that liquidity that the Fed is providing to begin to ease the situation, and then you can start to look at opportunities to be working your way out of dollar longs. Also, the point I would make is as well that when we start to look at some of the volatility selling options against some of these really big corporates, like some of the oil corporates, for example, who've been battered down by this sharp decline in oil prices, some of these things are also starting to look attractive, where you would be gathering some of this equity in at much discounted prices, even where we are today. So they're the sort of things that you would start have to do right now, the here and now, until we start to see the dollar squeeze wind its way out.
Yeah, you mentioned about the oil players. You know, what levels are you watching out for crude now?
What I would say is that one of the biggest issues perhaps is not the supply side so much for oil. Yes, we have ample supply, and inevitably we're going to hit tank tops at these sort of levels of supply relative to demand. But the real underlying issue here is what we started with was the fact that demand is incredibly weak. It's actually the demand side which is adding significant crude into inventories. I wouldn't be keen to be calling the bull run in oil now.
And that was Wayne Gordon, Executive Director for Commodities and Foreign Exchange at UBS Global Wealth Management. And coming up, more on how to weather the storm sweeping through financial markets. You're listening to Bloomberg Best. This is Bloomberg Best. I'm Denise Pellegrini. We're getting a warning from Mohammed El Arian. He is, of course, chief economic advisor at Allianz, and he's also a columnist for us here at Bloomberg Opinion. And he tells our Jonathan Farrow, there's going to be a lot of economic pain because of the coronavirus. Check it out.
Let me first start by thanking you and the team for your amazing reporting and for being there for us all. Look, my warning has been economic stops, sudden stops start small. They cascade, and then they reach critical mass. We reach critical mass globally, and now we have reached critical mass nationally. And that brings the whole economy to a virtual stop. It will start, unfortunately, disrupting more and more relationships. It is something that is necessary because social distancing is the only way to starve this virus from what it needs to spread. So it is, people will rightly put health in front of the economy, but there will be significant economic and financial damage.
Mohammed, we've spent 2 months debating scope and severity. How bad would it get? How wide would it spread? And for me, the big unknown now is longevity. How long will it last? And for me, every single second half call hinges on a pretty uncertain guesstimate about when this mitigation and containment effort will end. Mohammed, how long is too long for this economy?
So first, let me say no one knows for sure, not even the doctors. And this ultimately is a medical issue. It's not an economic issue. So no one knows for sure. And all of us are scrambling to put together a collage that comes from our own experiences, our own contacts, our analysis. So this is really a gut feeling. But it's also important to know the initial conditions. And we're starting from initial condition where the cognitive mindset is not open to what we're going through. Very, very few people understand the economics of sudden stops. Even fewer understand the economics of fear. And we're just starting to understand the economics of circuit breakers. So the analytical underpinning are massively catching up. All this is a long way of saying that I fear, John, that people are still over-optimistic. They're applying old mindsets, old model. They're looking for precision that doesn't exist. This notion that you can predict GDP declines, we simply don't know. There's so much we don't know. But my feel is that consensus, unfortunately, is still too optimistic.
So let's talk about the downside risk and why you think it's too optimistic. We've been talking about continually, you and myself, on air and off air and behind on the phone as well, Mohammed, about what would happen next. And my worry continually has been that the longer this goes on, the more we risk a series of deleveraging, a period of defaults that sticks with us long after this health crisis fades. Is that downside risk, is that your base case now, Mohammed?
It is, unfortunately. People now realize that a recession is likely. I don't say it's likely, it's just likely. It's a done deal. The global economy is going into recession. Economic deleveraging, that is what unemployment does. We're seeing supply destruction at the same time. So it's not just demand destruction, but supply destruction. And the big question mark out there is how far will the financial deleveraging go? Because when you get simultaneous economic and financial deleveraging, you need a whole host of circuit breakers. And these are not easy to design on the run. So I fear, again, that times when you hope your prediction is right, that times when you hope your prediction is wrong, here I hope my prediction is wrong. But I fear that we still are underestimating the depth of this recession that's going to hit the economy and what it's going to do to financial relationships, including a whole host of payments difficulty and defaults.
And that was Mohammed El-Aryan, Chief Economic Advisor at Allianz and Bloomberg Opinion columnist, with our Jonathan Farrow. You know, as the news cycle goes parabolic, we're getting a lot of advice from investors, including from Alfred Lin. He's partner at Sequoia Capital. Sequoia actually sent out a memo more than 2 weeks ago warning about the impact of the coronavirus, making it one of the first venture capital firms to sound the alarm. He speaks here with Bloomberg's Emily Chang.
Well, thank you, Emily, for having us on the show. We sent that memo because we wanted to signal to our founders that they should take it seriously, and we want to sort of go back to first principles. And the first thing, first and foremost, this is a health crisis. So we want everyone to take care of themselves and their family and their employees and their community. And then second, as a business leader, we have to take this seriously, and we need to focus on survival. For many of our founders, that means focusing on their cash flow and understanding how much cash they have to get to the other side. And I think we will get to the other side. We at Sequoia, we've been in business for 47 years. We've seen many crises. Every crisis looks different. This is first and foremost a health crisis. The last one was a financial crisis. The one before was 9/11. And we will get to the other side of this, but in each and every one of these, the most important thing is to stay healthy, not to panic, and to focus on your cash flow.
So let's talk about the financial crisis. You steered Zappos through that as COO and CFO back in 2008, which was the same year that Sequoia also sent a famous memo, RIP good times. Do you think what we're seeing now is going to be worse than the financial crisis?
I'm not an economist. I don't try to understand those particular details, but I can also tell you that we have a lot of people working on this, meaning scientists trying to figure out how we get to the other side of this. I'm hopeful that in two months, we will see whether we handle this as well as China did, or Hong Kong did, or South Korea did, or maybe not. And I'm hopeful that we are going to get to the other side of this. In terms of the Zappos,
okay, so then
the other crisis that hit Zappos harder was actually 9/11, when sales went to zero for a few weeks. And we knew exactly what to do during the financial crisis because we saw sales drop significantly as well. And again, each one is different and the magnitudes are different. But we have examples from around the world where we can see ourselves getting to the other side in one or two quarters.
So then I understand that, you know, you believe this is a health crisis first, but what is your message to entrepreneurs and to companies right now about trying to ensure the survival of their business?
For leaders, for business leaders, it's important to first focus on your health and then secondarily on survival. And again, back to understanding how much cash you have. In our memo, we mentioned to think about, do you have enough cash to last one or two bad quarters, if not longer? It'd be nice to have more than 12 months of cash runway, if not more. And if you are in a situation where you are in that shape, then great. If not, then let's think about all the right trade-offs that you need to make to get to the other side of this.
So let's talk about Airbnb, where you are an investor. Sequoia is an investor, a company that's been hard hit by the disruption to the travel industry. This is a company that said it intended to be public by the end of this year. Given the uncertainty around Airbnb's business model right now, how does this impact Airbnb's path to the public markets? Do you still think they should go public this year?
Well, they're in a quiet period, so I can't comment on that. They did put out a statement that they intend to be public in 2020. I think the main thing to focus on for them is I have great confidence in the management team that they are looking at what they need to do to get to the other side of this. Travel is hard hit, but travel will rebound. We are a society that is social. We are aspirational, and we will come out of this at some point in time. And the conversations around Airbnb are all about making sure we do the right thing for the guests and the host and for the employees and for the community and for the stakeholders. And so they're being very rational about what they need to do to make those trade-offs.
What about DoorDash, another Sequoia company? We broke the news earlier this year that DoorDash in February had filed paperwork to go public. This is a company that has continued to make rent by subsidizing the business in part on cash from Sequoia and others. Can DoorDash continue to move forward towards becoming a public company? And how does this situation impact their cash situation?
I think I can't comment on the financial performance of the company since they are in a quiet period. What I will also tell you is Tony and his team are also very, very clear-minded. And I think that they are very, very focused on making sure they also get to the other side.
What about M&A in this environment? You know, there's been speculation about, and I know I'm asking you, some sort of privileged questions, but, you know, hoping you can give us some view on them. You know, you're also a personal investor in Uber. There was some talk about Uber potentially acquiring DoorDash. Could something like that happen in this environment, or might that make sense? And might we see other instances of tech M&A as a result of this?
I think the M&A environment is ironically correlated with how people feel about their stock. And so M&A, in times like this, it's probably the best time to buy. And so I encourage companies that have good balance sheets to think about whether they should focus on M&A, but they're going to be, for all of them are going to be focused on survival first and foremost. And so I suspect that M&A will come to a bit of a slowdown. And then when we see ourselves coming out in one or two more quarters, we probably will see more M&A when people get to the other side of this.
Alfred Lin, partner at Sequoia Capital, with Bloomberg's Emily Chang. And that is it for this hour of Bloomberg Best. I'm Denise Pellegrini. This is Bloomberg.